Good morning, everyone. Someone pointed out, they said they figured I must have been the speaker because I'm the only one they didn't recognize. So hopefully I'll... But the difficulty of coming in when you haven't been here for the whole weekend is I have no idea what relationship jokes people told you, what great line, you know, like, so I'm clueless. So do me a favor, if I tell you a joke that you heard already, laugh anyway. Just, you know, it's recorded, my wife's gonna listen to it, she'll, you know, think that I'm not funny, she tells me not to tell jokes anyway. I'm gonna try to do something a little bit different than perhaps you've done over the course of the weekend. My sense would be after a couple of days that you might be lectured out a little bit. So we're going to try to do something a lot more interactive, and even more interactive than perhaps you're familiar with. I'm going to try to make this as workshop oriented as possible, in the sense that when I went through the training program with PAIRS, which is a fantastic marriage enrichment education program, one of the things that I took away from there, aside from an enormous wealth of amazing ideas, was also a perspective on marriage education. And what I realized is, if we're in an environment, and we've taken the time to come to an environment, we're working on something, to not take the time to actually get a chance to practice it. You know, the reality is that when we walk out of here, we'll have a ton of ideas swimming around our heads. This lecture and that lecture, we'll have the handouts and we'll remember this or that. But when push comes to shove and things are tense or some stresses occur and we start reacting, we're going to come back and revisit this idea in a little bit, we start reacting instinctively, if we haven't kind of started training ourselves in the type of activities, actions, behaviors, interactions that we like to actualize, if we haven't started training ourselves and it's kind of feeling what it's like to experience that, oftentimes the great ideas that we walk away with get lost. So it is going to require some getting up, some moving around. It's in a couple minutes, I'm going to ask everyone to kind of take their chairs and move apart. If you're not here with your spouse, if you can get your spouse here, that would be great. If not, if there are a couple of singles, people that are not here with their spouses, we can pair them up, because you are going to be working with your spouse for a good part of this. I'm going to try to introduce some actual tools that you can use, on a day-to-day basis, and I'm going to suggest that we're going to take some time to practice them and share some of the ideas. Okay. The topic of the session was from martial arts to the art of marriage, I think, or something along those lines. Communication. We all understand communication is probably the most single, most important building block of an effective, of a healthy, of a thriving marriage. The reality is, I find in a lot of the work that I do, that to a large extent, a lot of relationships... Have you ever watched toddlers play in a play group? So there's something called parallel play. Right? Kids, little toddlers parallel play. They're not actually interacting with one another. They're just playing alongside one another. I find oftentimes marriages sometimes look like parallel play, where couples get married and they're both living their lives parallel to each other and they're doing it together in the same playground or in the same sandbox. And that's kind of what marriage is. And there's no real engagement. And we pay a lot of lip service in, particularly in Jewish talks about marriage and most talks about marriage, about the idea that marriage is about building oneness, and we know that Ahava is the gematria of Echad, is the same numerical value, and it's oneness, and marriage is building oneness, and togetherness, and it's a new entity, it's above me and you, there's a we, all those kind of things. And I don't know whether or not we really take it the next step and talk about what that really means and how we utilize communication. And there are many tools to utilize, but how we actually build that concept. The challenge is, I think, that, and this is, again, this is one of these cliches in marriage, the challenge is in utilizing communication to come together, is that men and women are very different. Right? Men and women are very different. I'm going to share with you a little story. Takes a couple minutes, but I think you'll appreciate it. A little bit about how different men and women are. Not my own story. It's actually a political satirist by the name of Dave Barry. There's a guy named Roger attracted to a woman named Elaine. He asks her out to a movie. She accepts. They have a pretty good time. A few nights later, he asks her out to dinner, and again they enjoy themselves. They continue to see each other regularly, and after a while, neither one of them is seeing anybody else. And then one evening when they're driving home, a thought occurs to Elaine. Without really realizing it, she says it aloud. Raja, do you realize that as of tonight, we've been seeing each other for exactly 6 months? And then there's silence in the car. To Elaine, it seems like a very loud silence. She thinks to herself, gee, I wonder if it bothers him that I said that. Maybe he's been feeling confined by our relationship. Maybe he thinks I'm trying to push him into some kind of obligation he doesn't want or isn't sure of. Roger's thinking, gosh, 6 months. And Elaine is thinking, but hey, I'm not sure I want this kind of relationship either. Sometimes I wish I had a little more space so I'd have time to think about whether I really want us to keep going the way we are, moving steadily towards, I mean, where are we going? Are we just going to keep seeing each other at this level of intimacy? Are we heading towards marriage, towards children, towards a lifetime together? Am I really ready for this level of commitment? Do I even really know this person? And Roger's thinking, so that means it was, let's see, February we started going out, which is right after I had the car at the dealership, which means let me check the odometer. Well, I'm way overdue for an oil change here. And Elaine is thinking, he's upset. I can see it on his face. Maybe I'm reading this completely wrong. Maybe he wants more from our relationship, more intimacy, more commitment. Maybe he sensed, even before I sensed it, that I was feeling some reservations. Yes, I bet that's it. That's why he's so reluctant to say anything about his own feelings. He's afraid of being rejected. And Roger's thinking, and I'm going to have them look at that transmission again. I don't care what those morons say. It's not shifting right. They better not blame it on the cold weather. Well, cold weather. It's 87 degrees outside. The thing is shifting like a garbage truck. And Elaine is thinking, he's angry, and I don't blame him. I'd be angry too. God, I feel so guilty putting him through this, but I can't help the way I feel. I'm just not sure. And Roger's thinking, they better not say it's a 90-day warranty. That's exactly what they're going to say. And Elaine is thinking, maybe I'm just too idealistic, waiting for a knight to come riding up on a white horse. But I'm sitting right next to a perfectly good person. A person I enjoy being with. A person I truly care about. A person who seems to truly care about me. A person who's in pain because of my self-centered schoolgirl romantic fantasy. Meanwhile, Roger's thinking, warranty, they want a warranty. I'll give them a warranty. I'm going to take this warranty. I'm going to stick it. Suddenly Elaine says, Roger. What? Roger says, startled. Please don't torture yourself like this, she says, her eyes beginning to brim with tears. Maybe I should never. Oh, God, I feel so. And she breaks down, sobbing. What, Roger says. I'm such a fool, says Elaine. I mean, I know there's no knight. I really know that. Silly. There's no knight. There's no horse. There's no horse, says Roger. You think I'm a fool, don't you, Elaine says. No, says Roger, glad to finally know the correct answer. It's that I need some time, Elaine says. Now there's a 15-second pause while Roger, thinking as fast as he can, tries to come up with a safe response. Finally, he comes up with one that he thinks might work. Yes, he says. Elaine, deeply moved, touches his hand. Oh, Roger, do you really feel that way, she says. What way, says Roger. That way about time, says Elaine. Oh, says Roger, yes. Elaine turns to face him and gazes deeply into his eyes, causing him to become very nervous about what she might say next. Especially if it involves a horse. At last she speaks. Thank you, Roger, she says. Thank you, says Roger. Then he takes her home and she lies on her bed, a conflicted, tortured soul, and weeps until dawn. Whereas when Roger gets back to his place, he opens a bag of Doritos, turns on the TV, and immediately becomes deeply involved in a rerun of a tennis match between two Czechoslovakians he's never heard of. A tiny voice in the far recesses of his mind tells him that something major was going on back there in the car, but he's pretty sure there's no way he could ever understand what. So he figures it's better if he doesn't think about it. The next day, Elaine will call her closest friend, and perhaps two of them, and they will talk about this situation for 6 straight hours in painstaking detail. They will analyze everything she said and everything he said, going over it time and time again, explaining every word, expression, and gesture, for nuance of meaning, considering every possible ramification. They will continue to discuss the subject off and on for weeks, maybe months, never reaching any definite conclusions, but never getting bored of it either. Meanwhile, Roger, while playing racquetball one day with a mutual friend of his and Elaine's, will pause just before serving, frown, and say, Norm, did Elaine ever own a horse? Okay, so men and women are different, right? And it's not just they're just fundamental. We think differently. We communicate differently. We utilize communication fundamentally differently, right? That's different than just communicating. We utilize the words we say in a different manner. There's this great series of cartoons. It doesn't take as long as the story. There's this great series of cartoons. This cartoon says what he heard and what she said, or what she heard and what he said. What he heard. Honey, why don't you put your head in a vise and I'll turn this handle until your skull explodes. What she actually said.
honey, why don't we just turn off the TV and just talk?
What she heard. You don't expect me to take care of the kids, clean the house, and make dinner, do you? What he actually said. Feeling any better, honey? What he heard. Did you justify your existence today? What she said. Did you ask your boss for that raise? What he heard. This is a test. One wrong answer may be your last. And there's a picture of him standing on the edge of a plank with the sword sticking out. So he heard, this is a test, one wrong answer, maybe your last. What she said, tell me all the reasons why you love me. Right? So effective, meaningful, and healthy communication is a mechanism that we utilize to bridge the gap in these differences. So I want to share with you one short idea. And we're going to spend a lot more time. Can you just take one and pass it back?
Where was that from Barry?
Dave Barry, it's around. He wrote it. It's a year. It's old. That direction. I want to share with you an idea, one short Jewish idea before we get into the interactive workshops, that I think speaks to why it is on a deeper level. Obviously, we can kind of intuitively understand how central communication is to kind of coming together. But I think there's a deeper idea, and that is that when we think about the idea that men and women are so different, are really to a certain extent polar opposites, just from the very essence of the story of creation, the idea that man and woman had to be two halves of that one entity. It couldn't just be a different being. It had to be two complete and total opposites. They are diametrically opposite to one another because they are the two halves of that being. So there's an inherent connection, but they don't look like each other at all. So what is the vehicle, what is the tool that brings us together? So in Torah, I think there's an idea. There's a machine, so to speak. There's one word, there's a word. The word is dat, das, knowledge. Now, words in Hebrew are very, very complicated because we can translate them into English, but when we try to apply that translation, thank you very much, when we try to apply that translation into the psukim themselves, when that breaks down, we have to realize that we're missing something. So if we look at where dat, where knowledge appears in the Torah, it's really much more complicated, right? The first time it appears, and the Lord God planted a garden eastward in Eden. There he put the man, and we had formed, and out of the ground the Lord God made to grow every tree that is pleasant of the sight and good for the food, the tree of life, which is also in the midst of the garden, and the tree of knowledge of good and evil. Now, what does knowledge mean over there? What does the word knowledge mean? Eitz hadat tovara. Yeah.
It sort of means to distinguish between bad and small.
It was something about distinguishing. Now, what's wrong with, if that's true, if dat means over there distinguishing between good and bad, what's wrong with eating from the tree? Don't we want our children to know how to know what's right and what's wrong? What's good and bad? What's wrong with distinguishing between good and evil? Okay, so it's an acknowledgement of good and evil. So what's wrong? I hear you.
What's good and evil didn't exist. There was no such thing as evil.
Well, it existed. It was certainly in the tree at some level. I mean, it was the tree of knowledge of good and evil.
There was no discerning. All actions were equal.
Okay, so hold on to that thought for a second. That's fantastic. I think you're onto something very, very, very deep over there. So then Dat appears again. Yeah, sorry.
So they never experienced it.
They never experienced it yet. She never experienced it before. Okay, so hold on to that thought. So then Dat appears again, just to make the story a little bit more complicated, in a place that is a little bit more relationship-based. That's the man, right? The Yoda Adam Skaba Ishtai, right? Man knew Eve, his wife. Now, what does knowledge mean over there? My son was learning Chumash for the first time, so I wanted to know how is he going to deal with this? You know, like, how is the Rebbe going to deal with, you know, knowing in the biblical sense? So he reads it, and he says, you know, and Adam knew Eve, Adam knew Chava, whatever. And I said, what does that mean? He said, he got to know her. I said, well, how so? Like, he said, I don't know, maybe they went out to coffee. Now, what's the deal, right? What's going on? Why? The Torah just, like, doesn't want to talk about, like, dirty words. You know, like, so it says knowing, like, it's like this Catholic thing. That can't be. I mean, the Torah speaks in overtly graphic terms when it wants to. The Torah doesn't need to couch over intimate descriptions of things or graphic descriptions of things. Right, uses a language of holiness, but it doesn't avoid talking about explicit things. So why are we using knowledge over here? So I think knowledge refers to something much deeper.
What was wrong with the tree? Why did God not want them to eat from the tree? He should know between the difference between good and evil. Because I don't think that was what the tree did. It didn't make them aware or aware or knowledgeable about good and evil. Knowledge, the word da'at, means to synthesize two opposites. Da'at is a depth of knowledge where I can see where these two things, which seem to be different, actually come together and meet. It's good to know good and evil as long as you know this is good and this is evil. That was great. The problem was the tree made them look so similar, made them look so one, that good looked evil and evil could look good. We could rationalize evil behavior to such an extent that it might even be a good thing. Don't we know what that means? I mean, haven't we seen that in our own existence? How someone can actually take something so abhorrently evil and rationalize it away such that they think they're doing something good? I was doing a mitzvah. Meanwhile, they were whatever type of horrible behavior they were doing, whatever it was, right? Or someone can take something good and so corrupt it and see it as evil. The ability to do that is the residue of the Eitz HaDa'as. The ability to see something good and not see it as good, but see it as evil, to synthesize those two things, that's da'at. That's the power of da'at. And that's what the Torah is telling us about Adam. The Torah doesn't care about them. It's not telling us about a physical activity that they engaged in. It's true that was the physical activity, but that wasn't the essence of what happened. The essence of what happened was that they united, that they became one. Da'at, knowledge, is a tool to draw together two polar opposites. The reason why communication is so significant is communication is the mechanism through which I make myself known to my spouse. I come to know her on deeper and deeper levels. Communication is the mechanism that I use to create an environment, to create an environment where she feels safe enough, secure enough, to open herself up and allow herself to be known. Where I can know things about her wants, needs, desires that might be uncomfortable for me, that might be difficult for me to reconcile, but I want to know her. And the more I know her and I allow myself to be known, I share of myself, where I peel away that onion. In fact, if we were to spend more time talking about this, I wanted to actually give a lecture about this. We could spend the whole session talking about the kind of the unwrapping of the layers of da'at and how the Torah actually talks about different evolving depths of knowledge and the deeper levels that I come to know another, my spouse, and how that brings us together, how we become, so to speak, a shared entity at the end of that process. Communication is the tool that we use to accomplish that goal. So that's about the extent of the lecturing. Now let's get to work. Virginia Satir, who is really one of the, in the work, in marriage work, really one of the, for me personally and for many people, and certainly in pairs, she is a giant of relationship work, of couples work. One of the central driving forces of her theory is the power of communication in creating and controlling and determining family dynamics. One of the things, and a lot of the tools that pairs uses, many of the theories and that pairs uses, are based on, some of them are her tools themselves, and some of them are tools that are just are direct extrapolations of some of the concepts she developed. One of the things, and this is the first thing I want to work on, is what she called stress styles of communication. She said as follows, and I think this is something intuitively which we're all going to see. We have no problem communicating when everything's good. Right? No, I've never met a couple that doesn't, at some point in another time, have great times. I've never met a couple that's all bad, it's always bad. I'm sure there are. I'm sure there are people that are that place in life. But even those people stood under the chuppah or stood at the altar at one point in their marriage and were in love, and they've had times that were great. Right? When things are great, everything's fine. The problem is, things aren't always great. Things aren't always great externally. It means there are stresses in our lives. There are financial issues. There are family issues. There are interpersonal issues. There are wants and needs that never got expressed and become revealed. There are, you know, one spouse does something to hurt another. There are lots of things that create stress in a relationship. What Virginia Satir posited is that there are fundamentally four kind of core stress styles of communication that most people revert to under in times of stress. Four styles of communication that we revert to.
And we assume one of these four postures in how we relate. The first step in any work that we want to do is knowing ourselves, meaning we can't know, right, what one of the beauties of GPS, but also the deceptions of GPSs, are that you don't have to know where you are to know where you're going, right? I have a class called Lessons I've Learned from My GPS, right? There are lots of them, right? One of them is that you can actually correct the mistake that you've made without yelling, unless you have the Jewish grandmother voice on your GPS, which, you know, maybe my parents have that. And, you know, it's just, you could, it's dangerous because you could fall over laughing, listening to it. You know, why go that way? Not to go that way. Right? Right? But one of the lessons is you never have to know where you are, at least with Google, right? At least with Google Maps, you have to put in your starting point. Because in any work you do, you have to know your starting point. So I can know, where do I revert to? What's my natural place? So we're going to go through these, and then we're actually going to role play them. I'll have you break up into groups of four, and we're actually going to role play them a little bit. And I want you to think, as we're talking about them, think about yourself. Don't think about your spouse. Right? That's everyone's first gut, right? This is what my spouse does. Oh, there's you, honey. Look right there, right? This one, right? That's the easy way out, right? I'm a rabbi of in a camp of the mountains, generally just over Shabbat, and someone spoke in the camp about the events of last week, and said that Matzial Solomon in Lakewood spoke last Wednesday, and he said that he was very disturbed by the fact that he had been approached on Wednesday by a number of people asking him what they should work on, what's the lesson from this that we should all take away. He said he was very bothered by that. Strange thing to be bothered by for a rabbi, like that's kind of what you want to do. He said, why? He said, because what people mean by that is, what's the one thing, what's the kind of like the political agenda issue that we can blame all this on that we're supposed to work on? So then I can say, oh, I don't have to worry about that one, I'm good with that, so therefore I don't have to work on anything. He says, I don't believe there's anyone here in this room that doesn't know what they need to work on personally. Right? Work on that. That's what he said. Which was really powerful, right? So we all have this tendency to kind of, as soon as we find like something to blame, we find it out there so we can say, oh, good, it's not me. Good, now I don't have to do anything, right? We all know where we're starting, right? Right. I'm preaching to the choir. We're all here, right? Okay, so what are these four? What are these four styles? I have them. I have these little pictures on the chart. Let's just go through them quickly, and then we'll role play. The first is a placator. What does the placator do? The placator, if I were to have like a pie graph where there's me, you, and us as three portions. Who does the placator, who just wants to placate, who does the placator invalidate? Me, right? The placator says, don't worry, it's all my fault. I just want to make the other person happy. I'm a people pleaser. Whatever you want is okay with me. I want to make you happy. I'm so sorry. It's all my fault. Right? And there are people that this is the, right, they look a little meek, maybe a little hunched over, right? This is the little timid cat. What's going on inside the placator? What's the placator feeling inside?
Resentment.
Resentment, maybe. What else?
Low self-esteem.
Low self-esteem.
Hopeless,
maybe, that they can't fix anything.
They want
to avoid confrontation, right.
Guilt.
Maybe guilt. Maybe guilt that's driving it, some kind of inside guilt, right. It's a lot of heavy emotions that they're carrying around, right? That unfortunately, what's going to happen with those heavy emotions? One of the pair's tools is called emptying the emotional jug. We all have jugs inside that carry all of our emotions. And the kind of the comforting, satiating, soothing ones are heavy and they sink to the bottom. And the more volatile emotions rise up to the top like bubbles. I was once at a Covey seminar and the guy took a regular bottle of water and a bottle of seltzer and started shaking them. And as he was talking, he was shaking both bottles. And then he made his point, he put them both down the table, which one do you want to open? Right, so the volatile emotions that aren't fulfilling us, right, are the ones that rise to the top and they're bubbling around. And what happens when you take a bottle of seltzer and you keep shaking it and keep shaking it and keep shaking it and you don't give it some kind of mechanism to let the pressure out in a good way? And we know what happens. It springs a leak or it explodes or implodes, explodes, or it springs a leak and starts fizzing off it wildly. My kids love that when we open the seltzer bottle, like, you know, I'll poke a hole in the top and then I spritz them around and stuff like that. But that's not healthy in a relationship, right? It's not spritzing around all over the place. Right? So that's the placator. The blamer, what does the blamer do? Right? The best defense is a good offense. That's right. The other person's got this, right? This is a common one. This is a common one for couples that are in counseling. Because what happens, what does the blamer do when I'm a blamer and we're in counseling?
As soon as something happens, what am I going to say? That's what the therapist said you do. See? Look what you're doing. That's what you're supposed to be working on. That's what the counselor said, remember? Right, what did the counselor really say? This is your side, this is your side, this is how the circle is working, right? So what does that mean? I'm looking at what? Your side of the circle, because that's what my eyes see, right? I don't look like this, right? And that's what the blamer does. The blamer always sees what the other person is doing wrong, right? If it weren't for you, everything would be fine. You never do anything right. What's the matter with you? Right, I'm strong, I'm, you know, whatever. What's the blamer feeling inside? Righteous, self-righteous, anger, maybe hurt. Why? Right, just, I mean, I'm feeling offended. I mean, natural, I'm feeling some sense of natural indignation. The computer is the person who says, "What are you getting angry about? Let's just look at the situation rationally. Don't get emotional. Why are you getting so emotional about this? Why are you shouting? I'm not shouting. Right? There's no feelings. Right? Yeah." Absolutely, absolutely. These are real, obviously these are very simplistic paradigms. What she was doing was kind of giving us some core types. People are mixes of them. Sometimes we'll utilize different ones depending on situations. But I think hopefully this will enable you to do it after you role play it. You'll be able to, next time things are a little bit stressful and you get into a conflict, you'll hopefully be able to stop for a second and go, okay, how am I standing? What am I thinking? Which one of these am I? And what we're going to try to do is we're going to try to identify a model which gets us out of all these four. Right? That's the goal. So the computer says, I'm fine. I'm not angry about this at all. I have nothing to worry. I have nothing to be upset about. Cool, detached, dry, monotone, right? Inside, what am I doing? I'm just closing up, right? No one doesn't have feelings. There's no such thing as not having feelings. So I'm going to close myself up and I'll deal with my feelings elsewhere. I'll go get them filled elsewhere. I'll do something. But I'm not sharing them here. And last is the distractor. What does the distractor do? The distractor buries their head in the ground. The distractor tells jokes, changes the subject, right? Just gets totally off topic. Doesn't want to deal with anything. Finds every reason in the world not to engage the conversation. That's the distractor. Okay, here's what I want to do. Everyone stand up. Real quickly, right? The faster we do this, the more we can get done. Just pick another couple, or if you're here by yourself, pick groups of four, because there are four personality types. Here's what I want you to do. Here's the situation. Someone's mom, someone's dad, someone's a son, someone's a daughter. The son has just wrecked the family car. Decide amongst yourselves, you have it on the piece of paper, who's the placator, who's the computer, who's the distractor, who's the blamer. And one of you take a side, and when, now, here's how the game's going to work. So each of you are picking in advance who you are, right? So everyone's one of the four. When I say switch, stay the person you are. If you were the son, stay the son. If you were the mom, stay the mom. But pick another stress style, but don't tell anyone else what you pick. Just take it on and just play with it. Stay the same person, just change your personality type. Okay, one, go. Pardon me? Directions are again. I think we got it. Directions are so father, son, mother, daughter. Right? The son crashed into the car. And you're the when I say switch,
there's
There's an old one which I've never done, which I also have to do, which is Okay, here's what I want you to do now. Break up from your group, stay close to your spouse. And what I want you to do now is I want you to turn your chairs, and you can, if you want to move around, just kind of expand a little bit or go to back rows. Just face me a little bit, but turn your chairs to face your spouse. Just give yourself a little space, because now I want you to start talking to your spouse a little bit, and I want you to be able to have a little bit of privacy. I'm not having told you yet. Okay.
Here's what I want you to do, real quickly. Facing each other, I want one of you to stand up, facing the other, right in front of the other person. So your knees are almost touching, and just talk for a second.
Anything you want, I don't care. Okay, switch roles. Whoever's standing, sit. Whoever's sitting, stand. Pardon me? Camp Kochavim? Kochavim? All right, everyone sit down for a second. How does that feel when the person is talking to you? How does it feel to be the person sitting down?
Crappy.
Thank you very much. It doesn't feel very good, right? There's an inherent imbalance. Okay, now I want you to turn and face your spouse completely. Don't face any other direction. I want you only facing your spouse, knee to knee. Put your elbows on your legs, on your thighs a little bit. Lean in a little bit.
Okay?
You're not sitting face to face.
We're getting there. Hold on.
I didn't give you content yet. We're just getting physical structure right. Right? Now just talk for a sec. About anything you want. Share anything you want to share now.
Okay, stop for a sec. How does that feel? Changes everything, right? It changes a lot. Okay.
This is what Virginia Satir called congruent leveling. Okay?
S-A-T-I-R. S-A-T-I-R, Satir.
This is what she called congruent leveling. What this does is, this is the beginning place of communication. How we physically engage communication. We're going to talk about getting beyond the content of the blamer and the placator, but part of the blamer and the placator and the computer is, or the distractor, part of that is my physical stance. In a blamer is pushed into the conversation. The distractor is disengaged. The placator is going to be a little bit more physically passive. One of the things that's critical in communication is creating an environment for our spouse, for ourselves and for each other, that is safe. When we feel safe, we are able to open up in different ways. How we physically position ourselves in a conversation. And you don't have to have every conversation sitting like this. But when you have to have a conversation about something that is difficult, when you want to raise an issue, when there's a complaint, we're going to talk more about the content of communication. This is really helpful. Think about how often we have conversations when we're not in this type of manner, right? When we're sitting next to each other and turned in a little bit but half turned away, when we are standing or sitting, when one person is lying in bed and the other person is sitting up next to the bed or sitting up in the bed, right? That's not an uncommon one, right? One person is kind of half asleep, rolled over, feigning sleep maybe, and the other person is talking about some issue that's really bothering them, right? That's not a safe place. That's not going to engender. If I want to talk to my spouse about something and she's lying in bed half asleep and I'm sitting up next to the bed, it's really important for me to talk about this issue that's really bothering me. That might be something that's bothering me in our relationship. It might be bothering me, maybe something that's bothering me in my life that I just want to share with her. I want her to be there with me in it. It doesn't matter. How safe do I feel to share and be open if she's not reciprocating that physical stance of communication? Okay? Another piece of this is what Peres calls the invitation rule. And again, you don't need this to talk about the weather. But when you want to talk about something which is important, which is sensitive, which you know from experience is something which has a tendency to exacerbate the situation. The Peres invitation rule is very simple. Ask your spouse if it's a good time to talk about it. Right? How often, that's right, how many people is that earth-shattering as a concept? Not earth-shattering, right? How many people actually do it on a regular basis if they want to talk about something? If I'm upset about the fact that, you know, if my wife is upset at me because I left the house this morning and didn't unpack after we came back from Shabbat, we camped for Shabbat, we came home last night, I didn't unpack and I left all my stuff sprawled out over on my bed, and if she wants to talk about that, and she knows that I have a tendency to get defensive because don't you know that we got home late last night and I had to leave because I had to go give this class and I hadn't even finished preparing yet, blah, 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 right? So I'll get defensive and she'll be, and then what's going to happen if I get defensive when she raises it? She's going to get angry, right? So I'm not even listening to her, right? So it's a stupid thing. But those kind of stupid things escalate into big fights sometimes. And all of a sudden, we started talking about the stupid laundry on the bed, and all of a sudden, we're not talking to each other for 2 hours. Why? Because we created an environment that wasn't safe for each other. Had she said to me, you know, there's something I want to talk to you about,
is now a good time? Do we have a few minutes to talk? Can we sit down and talk about something? And I say, and now I hear, okay, there's something on your mind. Now, I have to be big enough to at least be able to say, it's not a good time. You know what? I'm just running. I'm coming back from the conference, and we got to go up to the mountains to visiting day for our daughters in camp. Can we talk about this tonight? Now, when you are invited to have a conversation and it's not a good time, what should you say?
After the time when it would be good.
Thank you very much. Right. You can't say it's not a good time, period. That's not okay. That's not safe. What you can say is, I really want to be present for this conversation. Now's not a good time. Can we talk tonight at 10 o'clock when the kids are asleep? Let's make some tea and sit down and talk. And I will make sure I'll have a cup of coffee so I make sure that I'm not tired after driving and stuff like that. Yes, ma'am.
Can you give a clue about what the topic is going
to
be?
You have to know your spouse. If giving a clue means that you're going to get your jab in and your spouse is go, if you're doing it because you want to make sure they know that you're ticked off, right, don't do it. If you're doing it because they're going to feel insecure by not knowing, the lack of knowledge, but if they know, that'll calm them until the conversation, then for sure you should. But very often, what will happen in that situation is, I, who have the complaint against my wife, let's say, I got to get that complaint out. I got to let her know I'm angry. I want to invite her and just like sit on it for 8 hours. But by 8 hours, I might not be angry anymore, and I'm angry right now. So I've got to talk about it now.
So why don't we wait a few weeks or months, then it's all out of your head again?
Oh, that's a good question. That's a good question. The answer is you have to know yourself. Not every issue, you have to know yourself. Sometimes if you find that when you get to the evening, all of a sudden you realize how dumb it was and you were only angry about the clothes because you were grumpy and the kids were screaming, then say, you know what? I'm really sorry. I was upset about the laundry, and I was totally foolish about it. Let's forget it. I don't need to talk. Let's just have some coffee together and hug. You know, I don't need to. That's all I ever want. That's
for sure true. You don't have, not every issue, the moment you instinctively have it, has to be raised in your marriage. Sometimes a little distance does give us some perspective to wait. Sometimes it doesn't. If it's something which you're going to just sit and it's going to eat away at you, you got to talk about it.
That's a problem.
Yeah. What if your spouse wants to talk?
That's not okay. You got to give a time. That's right. You say, if they don't, so let's say the person says, I just can't find a good time. So then you need to say to them, I understand you're really busy. This is really important that we do find some time. I don't want to talk about it, not at a good time, but I'd like you to find some time, in the next day or so when we can talk. I'm happy to wait on it, to sit on it, because I only want to talk about it at a good time, but I'd like you to find some time in the next couple days. If they don't, if they're not willing to do that, then you have a different problem. Meaning one of the things that, right, yeah, no, for sure. One of the things that we kind of put out there when we do a pair seminar is, pairs is very, very effective in an environment where both sides want to create an environment of safety and security for the other. And if one side isn't playing the game, or there's issues of abuse, emotional and physical, these type of things, right, that changed the term. There are other ways of dealing with it, but these tools are effective for couples, right? We're doing this here. These tools are effective for couples where both sides are on the same page in what they want. They might not be on the same page with where they are, but certainly what they want, where they want to go. So both sides want to create that environment, but they might need the tools and the instructions and the guidance to be able to do it, right? Yeah.
It also seems that it's the way we say it. Because the way you said it wasn't simply, I don't want to talk about it now, let's talk about it at 10 o'clock. You didn't say that. What you said was, I know this is important to you. I do want to hear what you want to say. Now's not a good time, but would 10 o'clock be good? I'll make sure I take some coffee so I can have my full attention. That in itself isn't only a technique to diffuse it, although it does diffuse it. But really, that's a communication right then and there of goodwill.
Right, but it didn't start there. Meaning, that's much easier when your spouse comes to you and says, "There's something I'd like to talk about. I don't want to raise it now. It's not a good time." Because what your spouse is saying to you is, "I see you. I see you. I see that now's not a good time for you, and I don't want to hurt you.
My goal here is not to win. My goal here is for us to grow. And I don't want to hurt you. And I know if I bring this up now, it's just going to be about her. So when she puts out there her care and her acknowledgement of your feelings, you have a much easier time reciprocating that. What happens is if the one spouse doesn't open with that, then the other spouse is that it sets the dynamic intention. Now, why are they good? There's everything circular, but that's one of the reasons why it works. Exactly. Okay. I want to talk a little bit about, I'm going to run through talking and listening. I knew that I wasn't able to get through anything, but I'm going to really try. I want to go through kind of some basic ideas, which I have down here on the paper on talking and listening skills. First talking, because this is kind of the content of what when you talk in this physical environment, you create the physical environment. Well, what do talking and listening look like? So talking is number one, direct. Direct means you want to make sure that you're saying what you mean, right? Don't beat around the bush. Don't drop hints or make people have to figure out what you're saying. I want you to know that it bothers me when you leave your socks on the floor when you get undressed at night. As opposed to, you're treating me like a maid. You're treating me like a maid is not a direct communication. What are you talking about? What do you mean I treat you like a maid? When I tell you what it is that's bothering me, again, there's a lot of pieces to this. We're going to talk about how to take this context and kind of build it into a conversation, but these are just some ground rules. Clear. One of the things I say when talking has to be clear, I tell people, talk in a manner, and I mean this quite seriously, and ladies always like this one, because they're sure that I'm talking to them about how they talk to their husbands. Talk in the way that a third grader can understand it. It's not only for women talking, wives talking to their husbands, right? Not because your spouse is a third grader, but because you want to make sure, your goal in talking, this is very important, your goal in talking is not to have said what you want to say. Your goal in talking is to be heard. It's very different, right? I say this sometimes just to wax religiously for a second. The goal in doing a mitzvah is to do the mitzvah, not to have done the mitzvah. If I approach a mitzvah in order to have done the mitzvah, I just need to get through it in order to have done it. My goal is to have done it. I go to daven, I go to pray because I have to have prayed. So therefore, I don't. There's nothing in the engagement itself. It's just I have to have done it. Therefore, I do it in order to have done it. My goal in talking is not to have spoken. My goal in talking is to be heard. So I want to make sure that I communicate in a manner that enables that I am heard. The listener has a job also. We'll get to listening in a second. But so talking the way a third grader can understand is I'm going to make sure that what I say, and sometimes it means I start and I say, one second. Can I just take a break for a second? I need to think about how I want to say this. Because I want to be heard. And so I have to make sure I'm saying it well so that I'm heard. So stop. Take a break. Wait a minute or two. I tell couples sometimes in a counseling session, I'll say, stop a second. Take a deep breath. Take 2 minutes. No one talk for 2 minutes. Just think about what you want to say and how you want to say it. And then start again. Take 2 minutes. No less than 2 minutes. And it changes the dynamics. Unbelievable. If I realize I want to be heard, so therefore I want to think about how I'm saying it in order to be heard. Yeah.
I just wanted to ask you, is written communication as good? Supposing you're the type of person who, if you're going to stop talking, you might not be that clear. You might go off the derrick. If you want to be clear and you write it out and you could see and, how does that break down in terms
of communication? Communicating the idea solely in the form of writing is a last-ditch attempt when you really are absolutely convinced you cannot communicate it well, and it's only an invitation to talk. Meaning, it's an invitation to talk where you can include the content, but by its very nature, writing is a step diminished in intimacy. The reason why congruent leveling is so powerful, and if we had more time and we could really flesh this out, I would have you just spend some time in congruent leveling, just sharing things before you even get to talking and listening. Just share some things in congruent leveling. If you reach in, if you actually hold hands while you're reaching in and looking at each other, you lean into the conversation. I'll oftentimes see couples where their concept of congruent leveling is both of them are sitting like this. This is not congruent leveling, right? This is congruent leveling. Feels very different, right? Someone once came to me in my office and they said to me, Rabbi Cole, I hate to bring this up, but I saw you out last night with another woman. I said, what are you talking about? They said, I was driving past the bagel store and I saw you there with another woman. So I started laughing. Who was I with? I was with my 8-year-old daughter. I had taken her out for some private special time. And when I take my daughter out for private special, it's not a parenting seminar, but I do a lot of parenting education, so I can't help but talk about parenting. When I take my children out for special time, my wife and I both, this is what special time looks like. I take my cell phone, turn it off in front of her, I put it on the table, and I sit down like this. I don't need this. And we just talk for half an hour. And this is how we talk. That's intimacy. There's an intimacy there. There's nothing in between us. Writing is a step below that. So if I want to invite my spouse, but I want to get some points out, what you can do if you feel you're better writing is write out what you want to say and then have it in front of you. That's totally okay.
But sometimes in talking, the tone can get in the way. And so a male from a male relationship, sometimes a man can take it. So I find if I'm writing an email, can just take the tone out.
It's true, but it also can put other tones in. Right? It's very difficult. I guarantee you, try it. It's very difficult to shout at your spouse when you're sitting like this. And your spouse is sitting right here and she's leaning in and we're holding hands. Like, it's very difficult to shout like this. We shout when we feel scared. We shout when we need to protect ourselves, when we need to build ourselves up to protect ourselves. When we feel safe, we don't need to shout. I can almost guarantee you, if you do this, you're not going to shout. It's just not going to happen. Practically, it's very difficult to shout. Again, if you are, you need to go back and work on things. But, okay. Okay. Clear. Talk like a third grader can understand it. Specific. Give them all the information you need to give. Don't be vague or general. Include the details that will help them understand what you're saying. Be honest. Don't exaggerate or embellish facts, right? What happens when I'm telling my spouse something that bothers me about what she did and I exaggerate something? What's going to happen? She's going to turn off, or she's going to go off on that, her defense is now going to be how I'm exaggerating and I'm not telling the truth and that's not what happened. And now we're on a tangent talking about that exaggeration and we're not talking about the issue anymore. Exactly. And last but not least, when you talk, be tactful. Even though you're being honest and clear and specific, you have to be tactful. Think about how you're going to say it. Take some time. One of the beauties of the invitation rule is more often than not, you're not going to talk right at that moment, which means you've got a couple hours to think about it. Maybe write it down. Maybe think about your spouse a little bit. How do I want to say this? If I want to talk to be heard, how do I want to say that? Listening. Listening is not what I do to rest my jaw while the other person's talking. That's not listening. Listening is an active engagement. Just the same way when I'm out with my daughter and I'm leaning in like that, I'm doing it to listen, not to talk. I'm doing it because I want her to know I'm here to hear, listen to her. That's a physically active engagement in listening. Listening is not always quiet. Listening sometimes has some very important noises to it. I hear, okay. Those are important listening noises. What are you talking about? Wait, let me just stop. That's not a listening noise, right? But, okay. Those are listening noises. Those tell my spouse, I'm present, I'm here, I'm engaged in this process. So listening is active, listening is attentive, concentrate. You cannot, give me like another minute or so, let me just finish this last piece and then we'll talk about if we try to at least maybe talk one more thing in the 2 minutes. If I am listening and you are typing on your BlackBerry, you are not listening to me. I don't care how much you tell me you are listening to me. I don't know how my wife knows it, but when I'm at work and she's at home and she calls me and she's talking to me and I'm typing on my quiet Macintosh keyboard, how does she know that I'm typing? But she knows, right? Why? Because I'm not listening.
She shouldn't be calling you.
Whoa. She can call me whenever she needs to talk to me or wants to talk to me. If I am busy, I will always, unless I, there's some tremendous onus, I will never, ever not answer her call. When I sit down for a meeting, I don't care who the meeting's with, and in the nature of the work that I do, I sit at some pretty high-level meetings. I always start the meeting and tell the person, if I'm able to, I only answer one phone call, but I try to always answer that phone call, and that's for my wife. I will tell her, hi, honey, I'm in a really important meeting. Can I call you back? She knows I don't miss her calls. She knows I'll tell her that. If she needs to talk to me, I will walk out of that meeting. Then you have no problems because you know when she's going to call you, so block the time out. What's the problem? I thought you were going to say, what if she calls you all day? So then the answer is, probably it's because you're not answering the call or responding correctly. More often than not, the reason why I feel needy is because you're not meeting the needs. So if I'm feeling needy, you know, it's one of these things with kids. We always find if kids are needy, the way to respond to children's neediness is by giving them what they need. When we meet a kid's needs, when kids misbehave for need of it because they just want attention, what's the best thing to give them? Attention. We have a knee-jerk reaction. Well, if they're just doing that to get attention, then I'm not going to give them that, right? Attention is like candy. And if they're just doing that to get candy, I'm not giving them candy. Attention is not candy. Attention is oxygen. My kid is going like this. And I'm going to say, well, you're just doing that to get oxygen. If my wife is calling me because she needs me, it's because she needs me. Now, it could be that we have to take a look at something and say, I'm not meeting the needs correctly. I'm not meeting her needs correctly. I'm not there for her when she calls. So therefore, it's not satisfying. So therefore, you know, kids don't get spoiled by love. Kids get spoiled by things. You know why? Because when you give me things, it's because you're not giving me you. When you give me you, I'm satisfied. If my wife calls, and while she's calling, I'm in the middle of five different things and I don't give her my attention, you're darn right she's going to call me back a half an hour later because I didn't give her what she needed. She needed me. And I didn't give her that. When I'm sure I'm giving her that, and she's still calling, then I have to figure out what am I still not giving her. Then we have to sit down and talk. Okay, real quickly. Listening is open, right? It means listening. And even though your spouse might be saying something that is not comfortable for you, that's hurtful, that's bothersome, listen, you can respond, don't respond now. Listen first, hear them out, let them finish, and then you can respond. And last but not least, respectful. Don't interrupt, wait until they finish. Respect them, right? Those are active listening skills. And careful, right? Make sure, endeavor to understand. Right, just like you want your spouse to endeavor to be understood, endeavor to understand. What that means very often, and this is a very effective tool, is don't respond until you're sure you understand. How are you sure you understood what your spouse said? Repeat what they told you, right? This is basics ABC relationship communication stuff, right? When your spouse says, I'm bothered by the fact that you did this and this and this, before you respond and defend yourself, make sure you know what they said. What I'm hearing you say is the following thing. You're bothered by the fact that you're doing this and this. Very often your spouse will say, I realize that's what you heard. I want you to know that what I heard is not really, what I said is not really what I meant to say, what I mean. So let me try to say it again. Very often that happens. It takes a long time to learn how to communicate clearly. So it's a hard process. It's hard. You'll get it, but it's hard. So make sure, in the meanwhile, while you're learning it, make sure you're understanding. And even if you're sure you understood, do it anyway. You waste how long? 5-6 seconds? If you've made up this nice time at night when you're able to talk, or during the day you come home from work for a half an hour to be able to talk about this issue that you made an appointment for, it's much easier to take the time to do it. You're relaxed. We have the time now. We blocked off the time to do it. Great. So now let's talk. And then I can afford the time to listen, to repeat back. I'm finishing. I started late. Okay. You'll have to invite me back next year. I'm not going to do talking tips today. Let's try one thing. Turn to face your spouse again. You're at level one. I don't care who starts. One of you pick something that you're going to share with your spouse. You guys are not facing each other completely. You're facing diagonal to each other. Pick something, if you're able to, pick something about yourself, not an explosive issue. Pick something about yourself that you want to share with your spouse that your spouse might not know. Something maybe that your spouse doesn't know about. Something happened, a piece of new information, something happened at work, someone you met over the weekend. Just something that you want to share with your spouse. But I want you to try it. Effective talking skills, and listen with effective listening skills. Repeat it back and make sure you heard. Try to elicit a little bit more information, maybe. Make sure you got what they're saying to you. And when you're done, flip and do it the other way. It might be how much you appreciate the fact that your spouse came on this weekend. It's always a good one. Congruent leveling is when you're, is what you're seeing. Congruent leveling is we're sitting, facing each other, engaged into the conversation, where it's when there's not an imbalance neither in how we're talking or how we're physically standing.
Is that a solution to
four styles? Yeah, to a certain extent. Meaning when we do this, we will generally avoid. This is good to know just to kind of see where we are. This kind of helps us get beyond that. Yeah. Generally not. That's very interesting. That's interesting. Generally, I find that they're in complementary or complementary meaning. One would be
a distractor.
A blamer is generally a placator.
What's a
blamer? Okay. That's
both Russian background.
Okay. Right. That's
interesting.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah, a few times. Okay, now if you want to take another minute or so, I'm going to finish because there's other stuff I wanted to do, but we're over time already. Anyone, if you'd like to stay around and ask questions, I'm not in a terrible rush to leave. I'm happy to stay around and schmooze for a little while. I'd like to suggest if you take another couple minutes, try to ramp it up just a little bit. Maybe try to, if you feel that this has gone well, only if you feel together this has gone well, maybe start with an invitation. Try to share something that's maybe a little bit more sensitive, something that you haven't shared that maybe you've wanted to share with them, which is maybe a little bit more sensitive. But now, if you don't feel you can do it in this standing in the room with other people here, don't. Only do it if you invite your spouse first that you want to share something, give it a try, and see how that feels. And I hope you'll see kind of a little bit of some of the difference. If you don't want to do that, you don't feel comfortable doing that, thank you very much for being a part of this. I appreciate you joining, and I hope this was helpful.